Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. Are you or a loved one struggling with a mental health problem? Is there anyone in your life dealing with addictions or behavioral challenges? Have you lost a loved one, or maybe you're having problems in your primary relationship? Do you have a teenager, a young child who is struggling with some mental health problems? On today's program, we're devoting the hour to listener questions and comments about anything related to mental health, behavioral health, or emotional wellness. I'll attempt to give you a reasonably useful and accurate answer, and certainly we'll be able to hopefully point you in a direction for information or people who can be helpful with whatever given situation you might have. So today is open phone lines. I'm encouraging listeners to call in. I will give you the phone numbers in just a second. So if you need to grab a piece of paper to remember it, that would be great. I had a couple of ideas for today's program that did not come through. And so I decided, like, do I do a repeat or should we just go on and see what happens? And hopefully people will call in and have questions for me or comments about mental health, how it's impacted their life, how they have been touched by it. We'll go over some statistics a little bit later on. Again, today's program, it's your chance to ask any question you might have about really any topic. If it's outside of my scope, I will certainly encourage you to pursue some additional information because I certainly can't claim to be an expert on a lot of things. So please call in or email your questions and be my guest today on Line One. Sharing your story and what worked or did not work in your own life might be very helpful to someone listening today who's dealing with a similar issue. Well, since this is a listener-driven show today, it seems like a good idea to share our contact information. You can reach us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. That's anywhere in the state or really in the country that you might be listening. That's 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. If this is the first time emailing, you got to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. Dr. Woodard always said he enjoyed these call-in shows, and I've done one before, and it was reasonably successful, I thought. So hopefully we'll get some we didn't do it service because we didn't have a promo. That was my bad. I didn't get a promo out there on the web. So people did not know and prepare questions. So I'll blame it on that if nobody calls. I guess I should start off today. I don't get a chance to do this very much by sharing a little bit about my experience and background so you can maybe better understand if you do call in with a question or a comment, the context from which I will answer questions and talk a little bit about why I do this program. I've been in the mental health field since, 30 years now, or 28-ish. Worked in a variety of settings from hospitals, mental health units, to adolescent residential treatment for substance abuse. I worked in a facility with violent autistic adults. My first job out of college was that, and that was quite a remarkable learning experience as far as like behavioral modification routines and keeping those folks safe and trying to help incorporate them into a community setting. I came to Alaska in 95, so that was quite some time ago. Moved to the Valley. Worked at what was then LifeQuest and the AYI program, which was the Alaska Youth Initiative program, and really enjoyed that. Worked in the community, home-based therapy, crisis intervention calls, so saw a lot of the Valley area, certainly during that time. Then kind of came back down here, ran some dogs for a little while with Linda Plettner's kennel, which was a lot of fun. And then moved down here to go to graduate school at UAA, where I studied social work, obviously, and got my master's degree. During that time, I had a fairly remarkable experience, which many of you are familiar with from some of the other radio shows that I've done. But I was a foster parent for, 12, 13 years, I guess. So I had the fortune of having some young folks live with myself and my brother. And so that was another opportunity to learn about the impact of adverse childhood experiences on developing minds. And so that's kind of where I really kind of developed my passion for working with teenagers, which over time has evolved into working with couples and parents, since they are the ones who are sort of molding and young people today, and my job is just to sort of assist that process. So we'll talk about some of that a little bit further down the line in the show today. So I guess I don't know if I have a specialty. It's couples, kids over the age of 10-ish. Don't know much about play therapy, but certainly could point you in the direction of some folks who do. So anything that you want to bring on or ask, I will be happy to take a stab at and hopefully get you some good information. So mental health, it's I think of it as a continuum, just like physical health. We all know people who are sick quite often, weak immune systems. We know people who have, seems like, psychological problems on a consistent basis. That kind of just keep cropping up, this thing, that thing. And, I think you can draw a direct correlation. We'll talk a little bit more about adverse childhood experiences later on in the program today, but a direct correlation between adverse childhood experiences and mental health problems or emotional problems, relationship problems as adults. So that is a direct correlation. We'll get a little bit into that more. So we're in about seven or 8 minutes, not that I'm counting time since I have a little bit longer to kill. Remind you, our phone number, 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. If you don't want to call in, send us an email. I'll give you time to think about it, and you can formulate a question. We'll go ahead and Marcia, you're on the air with me, Prentice. Go ahead.
Hey, Pren, how are you doing?
All right.
Good. Hey, I just wanted to first thank you for having this show. It's such an important topic, and just extend my gratitude. One of the questions I often have, especially with a teen family member in my life, is how to connect. And knowing that they've struggled with anxiety and depression, and I've had other family members struggle with anxiety and depression that I've helped out, but I often struggle with what to talk about. Sometimes when you pick up the phone and you call a teenager, it's like silence, right? So I try to get creative and just Google jokes, and I'll just call randomly and tell a joke and be like, make them laugh and then get off the phone. I've often tried to just be face to face. I know that works best, but when that doesn't happen, I just didn't know if there was any other creative ideas or ways to connect, to just help them feel supported.
Well, Marcia, knowing you, and I'll have to disclose that Marcia's one of my backup callers who called in case things weren't working, but it's a great question, Marcia. And I think you already, do the things that are required to connect. I mean, I know that you guys spend a lot of time outdoors. I know that you have opportunities to walk with your kids and to go out into nature where, kids kind of open up, the paddleboarding stuff. There's lots of good opportunities to connect. And sometimes it's really not, I tell people, it's not what you say. It's just being present and having them know that they see you and that you're a human and that you support them and care about them and you're flawed just like they're flawed. And you connect with them at that human level, and still you're safe. You have limits, you have boundaries, and they know that they can count on you to keep them safe in those situations. So I think you do most of what we suggest is get outside, get unplugged, get them off of the devices if possible for chunks of time. I mean, we have it all backwards with that stuff. So it's hard, but it takes time and energy. And the more adults, I mean, those are the protective factors that we talk about in ACEs. And the protective factors are the number of adults, or one of them is who are the positive adult role models in your life that keep you safe and are consistent, right? The fact that you show up and that you're available is huge.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because even though I am making phone calls and even though I'm trying to get together, like even just driving out to their house and just saying, hey, do you have 10 minutes? Can we go for a walk? And just taking that extra step. I mean, I know we are getting out and we do stuff, but, you know, 2-3 weeks can fly by and it's like, have you seen this person? Have you physically touched them? Have you given them a hug? Because I will, you know, I'll, you know, let them know like, hey, you're on my weekly phone call, you know, and I'll give the phone call. But recently I have felt like that's not enough, you know, and I think that is a good important, you know, for certain individuals that we may be struggling to feel from our insides that we are connecting with, that we are physically being with them. And that's a good point. And just making sure we're actually driving the miles to see them face to face. Some of my nieces and nephews, I'll do drive by hugs.
Yeah,
and
that's great.
Like, okay, you know, I'm showing up. But the ones that live a little bit further, you know, out in the valley, like that are a little bit harder to get to, I don't have that opportunity as much. But, you know, maybe that's the next, you know, hiking trip that we take as a family, as we go out to the valley and do just that. So that's a good point, because I have been struggling. So it's sometimes the obvious is the hardest to see.
And Marcia, the best you can do is send a text that says, hey, yeah, I hope you had a good day and I was thinking about you. These kids are oftentimes really connected through social media and text. And, you know, it's a tool that I have some issues with for sure, but it's also a way just to, wow, she thought of me today. Like, she's there.
Yeah.
Even if she's not physically with me, she's thinking about me. And that's important for a lot of young people who often feel disconnected and, you know, from their homes or their families, or they're struggling with substance abuse, homelessness in their families. I mean, depending on what the issues are, but just having an adult who's there is important.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, and that is a good point with the text and just those reminders, right? And I think some of this that may appear to be common sense is not always that common, or, I did that, or I got out of the habit.
All right. Well, thank you for getting us started off, Marcia, and sure. keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for your work with all those kids.
All right. Thanks so much, Prentice. Take care.
Okay. We'll take, since we got some lined up, we'll go ahead and go to Carl. You're on line one. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you so much for taking the call.
Certainly.
I've been recently dealing with some mental health issues, certainly some depressive type issues, and related to the passing of a family member, a close family member. And the question I have today is basically, when I think about, you know, trying to find a starting point in care, I find that to be totally daunting. And I'm a reasonably savvy adult who's successful enough in his own life. And, you know, I can find a restaurant to go to have dinner at, and I have tons of resources, and people will tell me where to go to eat. That's good. But people don't converse that way about mental health professionals. And so I'd just be interested to know what sort of feedback you might have for how you go about that search. What resources would you point me in the direction to begin, you know, the process of trying to find an appropriate healthcare provider?
All right. So you're asking, how do you find a good therapist?
Yeah,
that's sort of that's a great question, and one that we usually sort of try to address. But I always tell folks the best way to find a good therapist is to, Well, you can start with a physician because oftentimes they'll have folks that they refer to. That's one way. The other thing is family members or friends or a school counselor. Talking to some of the school counselors, they're often connected with therapists. But the most important thing, I think all the research indicates, the most important thing in finding a therapist is one that is a good fit for you. And that's hard to know until you actually get a chance to speak with them. So get some names and then find, you know, pick up a phone and call them. And hopefully they will call you back at some point. Some of my folks would tell you that I don't do so great with that. But anyway, they should give you a little bit of time just to kind of say, hey, what's the problem? And you get a feel for them. So, and don't be afraid after the first time, if it's not a good fit, to move on to something different. Doesn't matter what the technique, it matters the connection that you have. And do you feel like that person has something to offer you of value?
Excellent. Well, thank you for the feedback. I really appreciate it.
All right. I appreciate the call. Thanks a lot, Carl. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and we'll take one more. Lisa, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi, Prentice. My husband was recently diagnosed with type 2 bipolar disorder.
Okay.
And he was started on meds or changed meds because we thought it was depression all this time. And so he has improved, and we've gone from like one good day a week to one bad day a week, which is obviously a giant improvement.
That's significant, yeah.
Yeah. But one bad day a week still sucks, right?
Uh-huh.
So what should we expect with bipolar? Like, what would be the long-term prognosis, for lack of a better word?
Bipolar is really about maintenance, right? It's about paying attention to routines. It's about paying attention to your medicine. It's about paying attention to like how you're living your life, getting regular exercise. I mean, all the things that you go to your doctor and he'll tell you to do for, you know, good heart care. But bipolar oftentimes does, you know, have a significant benefit from medications. And it's important to be followed up regularly. Anything that somebody can do to be an informed consumer, right? To know what it is you're taking, why you're taking it, how it's making you feel, what are your moods, what are the triggers, to a bipolar event, or how do you know when something might happen? You know, a friend of mine used to say, if you can predict it, you can prevent it. So if you can see bipolar coming, and I've had some clients have some good luck with sort of knowing kind of the precursors or some of the symptoms that, you know, starting to feel antsy or ramped up. I mean, depending on how his is manifested, is it primarily depression or is it ups and downs?
Yeah, I would say it's like depression / not aggression, but like irritability.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It's super important that I think also, in addition, medications are fine as a stabilizing force, but I think it's so important for him to have an ongoing relationship with somebody that he can really be open and honest with and not you know, have to hide things or be embarrassed by. So a therapist relationship is really, really important, I think.
Okay.
All right. I appreciate the call, and thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Okay. We are sort of we have a new system going here. We're doing breaks every 20 minutes. We've been doing it for a while, and we're up on that. We don't have any calls left, so we'll go ahead and take our 20-minute break. For those of you who might just be tuning in, today's program is devoted to answering your questions about anything related to mental health, relationships, parenting, addictions, depression, anxiety, trauma. Nothing's off limits, so don't hesitate to call in. I'm encouraging you to call in, share if you have an experience or something that maybe others could learn from your own life, please add that as well. The ways to reach us, our local phone number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, I'll return hopefully with more of your calls. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
Listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. For those of you who might be just joining us, my guest today is whoever calls in and wants to participate on the show. I'm here solo today, so we're devoting the program to answering your questions the best that we can about anything related to mental health, relationships, parenting, addiction, depression, anxiety, trauma. If you have a question or a comment, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. All right, so before the break, I was talking a little bit. We were kind of out of callers, but I think we're getting a couple here. But I do want to talk just briefly about some of the reasons for doing this show today is some of the prevalence of mental health problems and the stigma that's associated with mental health is something that I really want to get out there. And for us to talk about it and have conversations that will make us realize that there aren't really any of us who get through life without some sort of significant, maybe not huge, but some kind of mental health problem, even if it's an adjustment disorder or a period of time or divorce or something like that, certainly can send us into a depression or anxiety. According to the CDC, an estimated 25% of adults in the U.S. reported having a mental illness at some point in the last year. And lifetime prevalence rates for mental illness in the U.S. were around 50%. So we're talking about one in two. So when I do say none of us get out of this without being impacted in a significant way with mental health, either in family members, addiction, eating disorders, now social media stuff. I mean, there's all sorts of ways that we can get bogged down in dissociative behavior. So right now, we'll go back to the phone lines. We have a couple waiting. So Vanessa, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you. Go ahead.
Yeah, this has to do with suicidal ideations, and I'm a parent of a child who has been diagnosed bipolar 1. Before we got to the bipolar 1, there was experiencing behaviors having to do with suicidal ideation, wanting, and then there was some grandiose and delusional behavior. So clearly, this person needed to have medical help, i.e. medicine prescribed, which was on board. But in a parent's quest for additional help, i.e. a talk therapist or psychiatrist, every door that I opened to get help for my son was shut, saying that he was too acute, i.e. suicidal. And my question is why there would be that kind of a block for parents seeking help for their children when it's so critical between life and death. Why so many doors were shut, and there were more than a handful.
You're saying that the feedback you got was that he was too suicidal. He was too critical for them to be able to admit to. You're talking about maybe a residential facility.
No, actually, I wanted to. What I did was I went to therapy and I asked my therapist, "Who would you recommend for my son to pursue counseling with, so that we can get him, you know, past this suicidal ideation point?" And there were no open doors. The only doors that opened were those that there are two points. Well, number one, I want to say this for the Providence Behavioral Health medical team that takes the crisis calls. Those are my go-to people.
Right.
If I didn't have them, that would have been sad. The other thing is that I was only told that I needed to go to the courts, have him tracked down, handcuffed, and taken into a residential home. So those were two avenues that we didn't really want to pursue if we didn't have to. But I think it's sad that with insurance on board and everything, that we weren't able to tap into a talk therapist or psychiatrist that would be willing to take somebody experiencing suicidal ideation.
Was it Medicaid? Or is it private?
It was.
Yeah,
but I also asked that he be invited into the room with my husband and myself so that we could work on compliance for medication and other avenues of that sort. And that was fully covered with insurance.
Yeah, that is one of the dilemmas in our current system, and it's one that a lot of people are taking on, and people should write, or could perhaps write their representatives about, is the fact that licensed clinical social workers like myself cannot bill Medicaid. We cannot take Medicaid unless we have a psychiatrist on staff a certain percentage of time. So I have psychiatric nurses at our facility. They can see Medicaid. I cannot. I can take all other private insurances. So now you have this backlog of Medicaid kids, oftentimes some of the most vulnerable in our population. And they're, as you are finding out, they're running into 9 months, a year wait list to get in with a therapist at one of the community mental health centers or somebody that has a psychiatrist on staff privately. I assume that's what you ran into.
To speak to that, we were able to get him to put himself on the Providence Behavioral Health list, which was at the time 400 people or something. And after a year and a half, he was able to get through and in on board. Since then, he's gotten a job and everything. But the whole thing was that with the suicidal ideation being so critical, life and death, that just to be able to, as parents, bring our son into a conference with our own psychiatrist or our own talk therapist and have him sitting on board with us, that should be something that should be offered. I mean, for these Medicaid people, and you know, that if you've got, since he's our son, if you've got something on board that is 100% covered with, it can just help to have him in the same room to have the conversation about why he's so valuable to us.
It absolutely can, and I guess that's kind of how you've addressed it. Sounds like you went with family therapy and pulled him in that route.
I'm sorry, but he wasn't allowed to come in with us. So that would be a great help to families that are experiencing this, that, you know, if parents have 100% insurance and they can afford they can get into a therapist, why not bring that so sick individual in with you and assist those parents with that caretaking that they're so hanging on to? I mean, it's a life and death issue, and I think that we could do better for the families and the mentally ill.
Well, and the travesty is, I'll add one more thing, Vanessa, is that like some of the recent research shows that people with suicidal ideation, their risk of suicide attempts is significantly reduced by just some talk therapy, some basic cognitive behavioral therapy. People feel less alone, less isolated, less hopeless
if they can
talk to a neutral person. So thank you for bringing up that issue.
Yeah, you bet.
And thanks for the call.
Yeah. And he's doing great. so we're good.
Glad to hear that. That's great.
Thank you for taking my call. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. All right. Good call. Medicaid definitely is part of that. Man, it's a difficult situation. I understand the regs are what they are, but it is causing a significant backlog, like I said, of some people who could really benefit from therapy services and perhaps get rid of the single option, which is emergency care, as far as, and correct me, anybody who wants to call in and correct me on anything that I'm incorrect with. But my understanding is, like, if you have Medicaid and you're in crisis, you go to the ER, and that's the point of entry, and then they want to set you up with outpatient care, and you get put on a 9-month or 12-month waiting list. So that seems like a bad design. People want help, and it's the opportune time to get it is when people are needing it the most. So let's keep going with the phone calls. Michelle, you're on line one. Go ahead. Michelle, you there?
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
I got you. Go ahead.
Hi. I was interested. Someone recently raised a point regarding the experience that beta males as a demographic, a subset demographic, would experience. And I was wondering if there have been any studies focusing on mental health issues associated with that specific population.
Can you clarify for me and other people what context you say beta males?
Sure, like an alpha versus a beta.
Right.
Okay. Harrison was talking about how, and what it made me think of was, I think if we look at some of the larger violence against larger groups of folks, those individuals, some of them may very well be able to be categorized and fall into that beta male demographic and would have experienced some of those things, i.e. like bullying and lack of potential romantic relationships because they aren't seen as an alpha. And so it was just an interesting question. I never thought of that as a subset population and having their own unique, specific experience.
Yeah, that's.
And I don't know if that's been something that's been addressed in academia and the sciences yet, looking at that demographic specifically.
That's an interesting question. It sounds like a dissertation, a doctorate study, and I bet it's been done. I mean, if I went to the Evolution of Psychotherapy conference in December, and they had an anthropologist, and I wish I could remember her name, but it was studying primates and that sort of male, you know, the alpha male and the beta, and how there's repressed aggression and how it spills over onto children and underlings, kind of rolls downhill. So those males are often quite aggressive, but not with the alphas. They go with the people who are more, or the primates who are more susceptible.
Right, exactly. And that was just kind of the observation that had been made to me, and I thought it was really interesting and insightful. It had never occurred to me to look at
perpetrators, you know,
of these recent mass attacks.
Well, you just said that, and I, you know, I don't want to go too far out there, but absolutely. I mean, you're talking about some folks who are obviously very disturbed and have some serious emotional problems, but you're also talking about folks who are had been targeted historically, often outcast, not the sort of, as you described them, alpha males. So it's an interesting question. But what else does it say? You know, suicide rates go up and down
right. Historically,
and our suicide rates currently are about what they were about 100 years ago and not as high as they were during the Depression. But what does it say about our society that in the last 20 years, suicide rates have like increased about 25% to 28%? That's a significant jump in a short period of time. And what about our culture is sort of, is it stress? Is it anxiety? All these factors. And are we stressing ourselves? Because it seems to be related to that.
Mm-hmm. Or shifting values.
Right. Yeah.
And the values that are, esteemed and held on high, those may be changing, and then certain individuals who maybe don't align with those values aren't deemed as worthy.
And the technological revolution and the loss of connection there, I mean, I don't know. You know, if we don't get calls and I get an opportunity, I have some information on that, and perhaps I can save it for another show. But, yeah, those are great points. I appreciate the call, Michelle.
All right. Thanks so much. Have a good day.
All right. Yeah, I guess the suicide question, I know I've done a couple of suicide prevention shows, and Dr. Woodard's done that. We try to visit that once a year, and it's probably time. But the suicide issue has sort of come full circle recently, obviously, with Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain. Suicides of high-profile people who seemingly have everything. I mean, it's not, it's obviously not about money. It's obviously not about, you know, having family, having children, having things to live for. You know, and there's a lot of stigma associated with suicide, which is makes it very, very difficult to grieve in a, I don't want to say good way, but in a productive way. So I got a couple of emails that I wanted to get to, and I will. So when I'll read one. When a toddler or child is subjected to physical and mental abuse at home, and then they start school and are subjected to bullying, it sets a very negative pattern for the rest of their life. This may be a major factor. 20 years down the path of life, that may tip them over into a suicide scenario, especially when adults continue to be bullies throughout their adult existence. I saw and experienced this in my own family. Those are, yeah, I mean, we're talking, again, we go back to adverse childhood experiences. When a toddler or a child is subjected to that kind of physical and mental torment at home, and then it just continues in school, it's reinforced. The number of adverse childhood experiences directly correlates to adult mental health problems. And you're right, 20 years down the road, anxiety, a young brain that is raised in or, you know, sort of, I guess, wired in a physically, mentally abusive home kind of is wired for fear, right? The parts of the brain that are responsible, the primitive parts of the brain, are actually bigger and stronger in kids who are raised in abusive environments or war-torn environments. It really is, you know, the survival. Whatever our brain is utilized for is what it gets, you know, better at, right? Practice. And that's what, you know, abuse and trauma do to the brain. And then you reinforce it. You continue to, you know, have experiences in elementary school, middle school, high school, and then you have somebody who's very fearful, untrusting of relationships, and often struggling in their intimate relationships. All right, we are we're kind of cruising along here. We're at the 40-minute break, so. I want to go ahead. We'll go ahead and take the short break, like I guess about a minute earlier. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. Today is open phone lines with me, Prentice Pemberton. If you have a burning question or a comment you'd like to share on the air, don't hesitate to give us a call. Your participation certainly will make the show more interesting. Our local phone number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, or you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, I'll return, hopefully with a few more calls and some emails. I'm Prentice Pemberton. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. For those of you who just might be tuning in, you are my guest today, the listener. We have open phone lines today for any mental health related question you might have. I'll do my best to answer them or point you in a direction or maybe just tell you that you're doing exactly what most people would tell you to do. So we're devoted to answering your questions, relationships, parenting, addiction, depression. Nothing's off limits, so don't hesitate to call in. You can email your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or you can reach us anywhere outside of Anchorage. You might be listening at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, the show repeats tonight at 8, so if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording, and we won't be able to accept phone calls. I guess we'll go back to the phones here, and Anna, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for this for doing the show.
Certainly.
I just want to share quickly my own personal experience with what I consider the closest call with suicide I've had. I'll say that I am now diagnosed with bipolar 2.
Okay.
And my mother was bipolar 1. She was extremely manic. Mine basically expresses itself in periods of manic behavior, and then I become exhausted, and then now I recognize it as being a state of depression.
Right.
But what helped me, my shared experience, is that through my experience in the military, from my time with my mother, I had been taught a lot about suicide, and I had been taught about what to look for, and yet I ran head on to a situation where I was right at the brink of suicide. And I wanted to share it with people because the things that led to it were a period of sleeplessness, exhaustion, followed by a state of being tired. I was not, the world is terrible, everything's awful, something bad is happening. It came across as I was just incredibly tired.
Right.
Just tired. And I could not understand, I couldn't deal with much anything in the way of noises and sounds. And I just felt so tired. What happened was, is I found myself on a bridge over Eagle River, and I was staring down at the water, and I was absolutely invested in the idea that what would it feel like to be in the water? What would it feel like to be, you know, basically gone? And I had no idea how I got to that place. I didn't know how I got to that bridge, except that I had been driving, and there I found myself in that situation, just that quick.
Wow.
And I think the best I can come up with is what I experienced was suddenly all that stuff I knew about and all the people that I knew of, it clicked. And from this tiny spot, and this is weird to describe it like this, maybe it's just how you are when you're in that sort of a state, but I remembered that's what they were saying. Ah, that's it. That's it. And I realized I was in extreme danger.
Huh.
Extreme danger. And I called the first person I knew because they had told me. They knew I had been depressed, and they had given me their number, and I grabbed that number and I called them. And the idea was, okay, you come here, I have a sub sandwich, I'm going to feed it to you, and we're going to talk about this. That was it. That was it, is that I had just, before I got to that point, I had talked to people, and I had shared my experience. And I want people to understand that dysphoria. I think you said disassociation was completely there, almost hallucination. What saved me, I think, was the pre to that, was the setup. So, you know, it really is important, as you said, connect with this person. If you can get them to admit that they're having these issues, let them talk. Give them their number. Just whatever you think would get across to that person, it can never be enough. It cannot be enough because the caring, the kindness, the concern, that person just dropping what they did and saying, hey, you just come over and we'll talk, got me to where I needed to be, to get help, to look at the medicines I was taking. And you just, I can't say it enough. Because I don't know. Give me 3 years later and a young person that I worked with committed suicide by jumping off of a bridge. And I don't know what I could have done.
Right.
But keep reaching out to people. I don't think there's a set pattern yet. We're not there, but don't, you know, if you're depressed, I want you to know, the depressed person, that it is not like in the movies. It doesn't feel like that always. And I've had other times where I've been that way. So try to understand this as much as you possibly can and get that list of people together. They made me do a suicide pact with them later, and it was some weird, you know, it was like, you know, little things. But I knew very much that I was wrong. So for the person who's depressed, do not take it lightly. Be very careful and build your chain of people to talk to. If you know somebody who's depressed, you know, do what they say. Talk to that person. If you're worried, ask them directly. You know, reach out to them. You might be surprised that they'll turn around and say to you, yes, I do need help. So,
all right, Anna.
That's what I have to offer.
Thank you very much. I think that's a really, it sounds like there was somebody that had spoken to you, Anna, at some point, and you remembered that, and it brought you back from the brink of something because you had somebody that was in your head that you could count on.
Yes.
All right.
Very much so.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Let's keep going with the calls. We got quite a few, so we'll try to make it quick. Caroline, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Past, present, and future. The past, people do what they know.
Yep.
And many years ago, I heard that the indigenous folks on the plains referred to the whites coming across as the people who beat their children. This is a generational thing. And anyone who has grown up in what I refer to as a lovely garden have no idea what the desert is like.
Right.
And they tend to underrate it, as it were, as being causal of any problems. We don't seem to be concerned about our families bonding. If you look at the areas in Scandinavia where people get time off and they have a chance to bond with their children, let's look at their suicide. And I keep hearing this business about it's monolithic, which means all white or whatever. But the point is, human beings are human beings. And the whole concept of the cost, I spoke to someone about the Danes and the Finns and elsewhere, and the person got very angry at me and said, I'm not willing to pay for that. Well, what are we paying?
Right.
We're paying a tremendous amount. The suicide rates, and somebody that might remember, it was on NPR a few days ago, tens of thousands of people between X date and now have committed suicide. And our young people that, what does it cost, $40,000, $60,000 to have a young person in McLaughlin? You could send them to college on that amount of money. But when families are torn asunder because it's generations of abuse on top of abuse on top of abuse, and that fellow that wrote the book, and I haven't finished reading it yet, The Child Called It, I heard him on the air, and he said something that was, to me, exceedingly profound, and that was, hurt people hurt people.
Yeah.
And again, if we don't take it seriously, we will have a major implosion. And I think part of the suicide increase has to do with how we treat each other. But again, a lot of us have been through bits and pieces of this. And if somebody were to break an arm, everybody around them would say, oh, for heaven's sakes, get to the hospital or get to somebody that can help you fix that. that's not the way it's been with mental health issues.
Well, Carolyn, that's a great point, and I got several more callers I got to get to, so I'm going to move along. But yes, you're right. The stigma, if somebody's got, you know, cancer or something, people rally to them and they bake for them. And the, you know, if you have depression or bipolar, or there's so much secrecy and shame around it, addiction stuff as well. So thanks for pointing that out, Caroline. Appreciate the call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Levi, you have a response about alpha beta males. Go ahead. You're on line one. Oh, he's gone. Okay. Ann, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I just have been dealing for the last couple of years with my really wonderful teenage son and trying to help him deal with his depression. And teenage years are bad enough, and at depression, and it's just that much worse. But he has some other issues too. And I guess what's frustrating to me is having been through some really horrible experiences as a younger child and dealing with mental health stuff, you know, people mean well when they say, well, just bring him to the emergency room.
Right.
Long story short, another state, my child waited all night in the emergency room because after 3 hours of taking sharps away from him, I didn't know what else to do. He kept on saying, Mommy, I want to die. I brought him to the emergency room. They took blood 5 times. They found a placement for him because they were trying to get him out of the emergency room, but it was utterly inappropriate. And after staying up all night with him and my other underage child, there was no way that I could drive across the state. So my child, at a very young age, went across the state in handcuffs, being lectured.
Right.
By a well-meaning sheriff's deputy. I'm saying all this because when somebody says, well, just bring him to the emergency room, you don't know. You just don't know what other people have been through. And he just looks at me and says, Mom, it might be different, but I don't want to do that again. And that's the only way that his psychiatrist will write a letter for him to go someplace out of state. And there's nothing appropriate for somebody here who is a teenager, is depressed, who also has other things going on like OCD and ADHD. He is a fabulous person, and I want to be able to help him. And I can't afford to just say to some random place down in the lower 48
right,
and deal with a variety of things, here's $100,000. Tell me when you need more. I expect that to be in about 3 months.
I know it's overwhelming, and it's you can't, I mean, that expectation can't be, it's not realistic. So a bunch of questions jump into mind. I mean, has your son had therapy? Does he have Medicaid or private insurance? Have you found a really good therapist that your son trusts and can and relate to? And I know for a lot of people, if they've had a bad experience with counseling before, it leaves, you know, a really bad taste in their mouth, and they might not want to do it again. But the fit is so important in therapy. So I would encourage, that's a place to start for your son. And you're right about the out-of-state placement and the lack of in-state facilities, and the cost is prohibitive.
So my son has a therapist. He trusts him.
Okay.
I trust him.
Good.
And, you know, part of it's also being a teenager, you know, okay, I don't like this message. What do you mean I'm going to have to work on my own, literally on my own mental health?
Yeah.
I just want to feel better. I know, honey. I'm sorry. It is work.
Finding it's things work that motivate, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's the job of the therapist, to find things that motivate your son, even if they're small, to make little changes that improve a sense of well-being and accomplishment.
And we've tried all sorts of medications, and so far, none of them have been terribly effective. And so me trying to say, okay, you know, these are the healthy boundaries for you. I know you're practicing adulting because you're an older teenager. And I still need you to do these things because this is what healthy adults do. It's not just I have more rights. It's also I have more responsibility.
Absolutely. If you can you leave your phone number with Dave and I'll give you a call back because I have one more phone call here that I want to get to and I'm almost out of time. So if you leave your phone number, I'll give you a call back and we can chat a little bit more.
Okay, thank you.
All right. I appreciate the call. Those are concerns that a lot of parents that I work with share. Kristen, you're on line one. You're going to wrap up the show today. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, hi. I'm actually a veterinarian here in town, and I was recently diagnosed with a fluoroquinolone-induced tendonitis. So, I've got multiple tendons set off. Basically, what the fluoroquinolone antibiotics do, like ciprofloxacin and levoquin, is they strip magnesium from your body. Uh-huh. This is a long story short, but that's part of what they do. But what has been fascinating to me, and it's fascinating in the context of your last three calls, which all relate to the terrible pain that surrounds mental health issues and things like that, is how much magnesium deficiency plays a role in mental health. In particular, insomnia, depression, anxiety, and bipolar disorder. 100 years ago, we were getting plenty of magnesium in the food that we ate, but modern farming methods mean that the soils are quite depleted of magnesium and you cannot get enough from your food. In addition, you can't even get enough from regular magnesium supplements because they're basically, you get diarrhea from them. The way they're structured, you get diarrhea long before you ever get saturated with magnesium. But magnesium is this vitally important mineral that nobody seems to know about. And part of the problem is that doctors are unaware of how to test for magnesium. They do a serum magnesium test, which is essentially useless. If they do instead a magnesium red blood cell test, and you use a particular reference range, then you can start to at least track your magnesium levels and get them better. But one of the first things that I noticed when I started taking heavy-duty ionic magnesium for my tendonitis was that I started sleeping better. It was incredible.
And so, we all know how important sleep is.
Yeah.
I got to let you go, but I appreciate that, and I will do some research. I don't know anything about that, but I certainly will look into it.
If you're just a shout-out for a book called The Magnesium Miracle by Dr. Carolyn Dean, if anybody wants some reading material.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Kristen. I appreciate it. Okay. My thanks to all the callers and emailers who saved me from having to fill an hour by myself. I appreciate the questions and comments and sharing your stories with us today. My hope is that having conversations like this will continue to reduce the stigma of mental health in our community. Please remember, we posted some good resources online about mental health. Just go to alaskapublic.org and click on the link to today's show. Next week, I return for a conversation with Line One favorite Bill Eddy from the High Conflict Institute in California. We will be discussing his new book, Five Types of People Who Can Ruin Your Life. So be sure to tune in for that discussion next Monday, June 18th at 2 p.m., repeating at 8 on FM 91.1 Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron was our web editor. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.